Chapter 5. Anemone. There is a photograph of the young T.S. Eliot, 7 or 8 years old in the summer of 1896, half perched on an upright rocking chair in the porch of his family's summer house near Gloucester in Massachusetts. One leg is hooked up under him, the other keeps the chair from rocking, and all his attention is directed down into the pages of a book, his hair curving over his brow towards it. He seems unaware of, or at least indifferent to, his brother Henry taking the picture. It is the world-excluding gaze of the truly absorbed. Look in, look carefully, find whatever it is that engages you most deeply. The Eliots used to spend 3 months every summer exchanging the heat of Missouri for the cool verandas of this tall, wind-visited seaside house, and during one of them, the young Eliot experienced something he never forgot, applying that careful, close scrutiny not to the pages of a book, but peering through seawater in a rock pool and finding a sea anemone for the first time. Looking down into the pool became a model for him of the way he found his poetry, with no conscious choosing, but the anemones lying dormant in the mind for 20 years, as if memory were a pool full of half-hidden beings, most of them unrecognized, waiting for the swimmer or shore-walker to push a hand beneath the surface and ruffle the weeds. Only then, as Eliot wrote, would the anemones reappear transformed, charged with great imaginative pressure. In Elsa, his catboat, he became entranced by that granite coast, by the grandeur of the Atlantic off Cape Ann, and the gardens where the salt is on the briar rose, the fog is in the fir trees. All of it surfaced in what he would write for the next 60 years, drawing again and again on those waters, so that in a purely Wordsworthian way, memory and imagination became indistinguishable to him. At first, he had described his 10-year-old self looking into the pool as having a simple experience. But then, in the lecture where he said that, immediately corrected himself. Not so simple for an exceptional child, as it looks. Not a careless glance, but a dive into the wonderful. At the western edge of the pool, on the Ruan Tasunach, where it shallows towards one of the volcanic dikes, the anemones were proliferating all summer. In some parts, by September, there were more than 300 of them in a square yard, all sizes, none quite touching, but each gently sifting from the surrounding water the food they needed. In other places I had found the wavering grey-yellow arms of the snake locks, and in cracks and crevices further down the tide, the green blotched strawberry anemones, their bodies stuck with bits of sand and coralline flakes, the variegated tentacles of a dahlia anemone, and some white elegant ones, as bright as candles. Here in the pool, they were all the usual beadlets, Actinia equina, the most common of all, slightly various in their colours, but named after the ring of little blue stinging cells, or acra ragi, a Victorian Greekism meaning high berries, arranged as a necklace inside the lip of the columnar body. The acra ragi are usually invisible when the main tentacles are up, but appear as the anemone folds down into itself when conditions are not good, if the tide has dropped away, or the salinity has fallen, or the temperature risen. Otherwise, these simple animals merely wave their tentacles in the passing water like flowers in sunlight. That is why they are called anemones, named only in the late 18th century from their resemblance to the flowers of wood and meadow. Brush your fingers through them, as the Australian poet Gwen Harwood has said, and you will find your fingers meet some hungering gentleness. The little stings the anemones give you with these red tentacles do not hurt, but feel more like a kind of stickiness than an attack. Some anemones are sexual and release their sperm and eggs into the surrounding water, relying on some chance union, but these beadlets reproduce asexually, making tiny, genetically identical versions of themselves, which emerge into the surrounding world as their fully functioning progeny. If you ruffle through them, you will find tiny anemone reproductions spilling out onto your fingers, each baby blob of life looking in a magnifying glass like a raspberry mousse. They are among the simplest animals, not very different from their long-distant ancestors, whose rare soft-body fossils have been found in deposits more than 500 million years old. They have no centralized nervous system, no brain, no organs of excretion. Whatever needs to come out as waste is ejected through the same tentacle-surrounded hole by which the food went in. Their muscles and nerves are simpler and less organized than in almost any other animal. They have no skeleton. Water pressure alone, held tight within the body cavity by the mouth closing over it, provides their solidity. Foods are dissolved by simple digestive enzymes into the chemical constituents that the anemone can absorb. They are scavengers, eating the dead and broken parts of animals that float past in the tide. High up near the grass, they ingest plenty of dead midges and mosquitoes. Further down, it is little sandhoppers, parts of prawns, crab megalopses, and lots of tiny unattached young mussels. In short, most of the characters that have populated this book. A large one has been seen to swallow a smelt 6 inches long. Some Irish scientists have tested the anemone's appetite for something more, popping rather large mussels into the oral cavity to see what happened. The anemones accepted the offering easily enough, and the mussels disappeared inside them while the scientists waited. Up to 2 hours later, the complete and uninterfered with mussel came back out. The anemone had been unable to get access to the meat. When the scientist cut the mussel by which the bivalve kept itself closed, there was a different outcome. Very nearly 9 hours later, the shells were spat out by the anemone, the meat of the mussel having entirely disappeared. I collected some from the shallows at the edge of the pool. They are easy to peel off if you lift them gently and carefully from the rocks they are stuck to. They come away almost exactly like post-its, closing their tentacles with the disturbance, but otherwise untroubled. The bodies of these actinii in the pool are red all the way down, the colour just paling at the foot. Some others that I found at the far end of the headland and on rocks lower in the tide had a blue line around the foot of their columnar bodies. Both were beadlet anemones, but of two different morphs, each living in slightly different environments. In separate lidded boxes filled with seawater, I took them back to the aquarium in the house and left them to acclimatise for an hour or so. By the time I went to look, things had started to happen. One of the bluefoots had been in a fight and had suffered in it, with pale wounds from its enemy's attack cells, the acroragi, stapled down one side of its body. An attacking anemone leaves part of the acroragus on the body column of its adversary, continuing to deliver its toxins even after the fight is over. The flesh around these acroragus peels had crumpled and puckered with the damage. The bluefoot had now moved to another stone, where again it found itself next to a redfoot. The two of them were meeting each other with their outer tentacles. Redfoot was bigger, its base spread wide, and oddly warty, with its tentacles fully displayed, while bluefoot looked less happy, tentacles retracted, a little inward. Soon, though, Bluefoot made its defensive move and started to lean in towards the Redfoot enemy, which reacted at first by pulling back some of its outer tentacles. It was a temporary withdrawal. Minutes afterwards, Redfoot pulled itself up to its greatest height, reshaping its whole body and contorting its blue attack cells into a tiara of violence towards Bluefoot, leaving its upper red tentacles withdrawn, hooked and clawed. It was a ferocious display of aggression, of selfhood, of one being set against another. Toxic darts spurted from Redfoot's acroragi into Bluefoot's body, sticking into the flesh, standing out from it like arrows in a target, and leaving white threads wrapped around the enemy's waist. For the second time, Bluefoot gave up the fight, detaching itself from the rock and starting to drift past and away from its aggressor. This attempt to escape resummoned all the defensive, aggressive instincts in Redfoot as Bluefoot rolled over and past it, revealing the pale grey underside of its foot. Redfoot once again came up into its flamboyant, menacing attack form. Bluefoot was now in a hopeless situation, upside down and defenceless, next to the fierce, charged presence of its enemy. As its crumpled body drifted past, Redfoot, still wearing its extraordinary erect war corona, bent over and down onto the spot Bluefoot had just vacated, and deposited there a single tiny new anemone, an asexual clone of itself, generated and brooded within its body cavity, placed to occupy the neighbouring area of rock that would now become part of its own clonal territory. Bluefoot was wafted away by the currents in the aquarium, finding a place at the far end, tucked down behind a large stone. Meanwhile, Redfoot, the crisis over, resumed its composure with its tiny, soon-to-be space-occupying clone happily settled beside it. That clone's minuscule tentacles were already sifting the passing water. These animals were not properly understood for a long time. The acroragi were first described in 1829, but were thought throughout the 19th century to be primitive eyes, or organs that were especially sensitive to touch, or somehow, in an undefined way, connected with defence. Only in the 1950s was it finally recognised that they were the animal's arsenal. How the anemone knows to attack a stranger and yet feel comfortable tangling tentacles all day long with a clonal relative is still only partly understood. It cannot be the mere presence of another that engenders the violence. Its different attitudes to relatives and non-relatives is so polarised because its progeny is genetically identical to it. These animals are not, in one sense, individuals. Everything that identifies the nature, reality processing and selfhood of one red-footed actinia is literally and profoundly the same as everything in the child it deposits beside it. Without doubt, the chemical smell-cum-taste of a neighbour was at work. This so-called clonal recognition depends on genetically driven chemical markers in the surface of the anemone's skin. Experiments have shown that although anemones will release the mild toxins in its red tentacles at almost anything from sponges to fish and my fingers, the acroragus violence is only ever directed at other anemones that are not genetically identical. Super murderous attack is reserved for them, and only when they actually touch the tip of the acroragus. Even a distance of half a millimetre brings no response. But should a wrong anemone come into physical contact, the only reaction, within a couple of seconds, is a massive discharge of aggressive poison. This passionate phenomenon takes one deep into the origins of consciousness. All life, even down to the level of bacteria, responds to the kind of chemical stimuli that is governing the anemone's reaction to a stranger. It is the most shared element of life on Earth. The chemical basis of smell and taste and the neural architecture by which those signals are delivered to the organism is essentially the same in all insects, crustaceans, mollusks and vertebrates, including ourselves. When we smell something wrong or get a strange feeling about another, we may be using some of these deeply buried neural habits by which the anemones are still governed and which had their origins far back in the pre-Cambrian world more than 540 million years ago, before other senses were invented or needed. Until that Cambrian information revolution, all life depended on this chemical form of communication. Only then, and quite suddenly, did the Cambrian bloodbath of predator-eating predator begin, a self-generating, mobile and ferociously competitive environment That probably supplied the selective force necessary for the evolution of the first brains. Where a predator could develop nostrils, by which it could detect the source of a smell at a distance, the advantage was soon obvious. Animals that had previously been able to hide in turbulent eddies, where the chemical signals they were giving off would be hidden by the riffles in the water, would suddenly become available to predators that could smell them by processing and understanding what reached them in turbulent currents. Look at a dog sniffing the air, and you will see that analysis of turbulence at work. The emergence of eyes, in both predator and prey, ramped up the arms race still further. Driven by these new means of detecting both enemies and food, animals quickly radiated into all the forms from which modern life is descended. The sea anemones come from before that revolution. They are living ancientness. When you know this history, they seem to be in the dark, quite literally blind, extraordinarily uninformed about their world, knowing only to ingest what seems like food, to accept as neighbours what seem like themselves, to attack what smells like a cousin, at least when skin touches skin. Many species of them hide, tucked away into rock cracks. Some, like the strawberry anemone, conceal themselves with bits of shell stuck to their bodies. Others are buried deep in the beach, visible at very low tide as strange, translucent, long-limbed stars that at one touch disappear into the sand. These beadlet anemones are not like that. They are everywhere on the rocks of this shore, neither hidden nor defended against us, nor equipped with any of the instruments of perception which the revolution in life 540 million years ago seems to have made necessary. And yet, here and elsewhere in the world, they are astonishingly common. What is the secret? The answer may be in the principle of cloning, a life habit shared by the anemones with other simple intertidal animals, the sponges, sea squirts and sea mats. All of them are able to tolerate their own clones as neighbours, and even to fuse with them. I am told, although I could not perform this experiment myself, that if you cut a fully grown sea anemone in half, vertically, each half will, within a few weeks, grow back to become a whole sea anemone itself. The cut edges naturally push together and rejoin to form a smaller animal. Those cut surfaces know each other as part of one thing and are happy to fuse. All of them are able chemically to distinguish non-clones and to treat them with appropriate violence. The result is clusters of anemones that are clones of each other, from which strangers are excluded and which can, in effect, be seen as a single being in many bodies. When the sea anemone rejects the non-clone next to it, it is behaving in the way a human body behaves when it rejects a transplant. It knows the interloper is not one of its own, is not, in fact, itself, and needs to be expunged. As a result, the anemone does not need to engage in the post-Cambrian arms race. Rather than compete, it proliferates, and in asexual cloning sea anemones, the individual is effectively eternal. It grows not by getting larger, but by developing more and more bodies for itself. Those bodies create still more bodies, and the individual anemone exists in every one of them. Its life habit is to say itself again and again. Destroy any single polyp, and the individual will persist despite you. In that way, unless a bulldozer or a sinking oil tanker arrives on the shore, the sea anemone escapes mortality. Itself is beyond any particular form of cells that happen to embody it. No particular body needs to become large. An anemone is its colony of genetically identical creatures, and its size may be intrinsically unlimited. The only resource that is limited is space, which is why the identification of a neighbouring non-self by a sea anemone becomes of such ferocious and overriding importance. The one thing the clonal being must guarantee is room for its new body selves to find a home in the world. The scenes in the aquarium came from a redfoot recognising a bluefoot. What is less dramatic but equally significant is the picture in the shallows of the pool at Ruhe und Tassunach, where a crowd of redfoots continues to sit alongside each other in what is probably a clonal gathering, not of like-minded individuals, but of a single individual, attending to its own welfare in all the different bodies through which its being appears in the world. Although the Italians occasionally eat snake locks anemones in vinaigrette or deep-fried in batter like calamari, all anemones are thought to taste horrible to most fish. Crabs ignore them, tompot blennies, small fierce rock pool fish, and the feathery common grey sea slugs both prey on them. Coiled strings of the slugs' bright white eggs have been appearing in the deeper parts of the pool, but the shallows probably protect the anemones from them. They are too open to bird predators for the fish and slugs to like it there or to survive for long. Besides, the sheer numbers and productivity of the anemones is clearly enough to keep the clonal individual alive. In some American anemones, whose clones cluster more densely than the European beadlets, a radical change has occurred, somewhere between the growth of an anemone society, if one thinks of each individual polyp as a creature, and the development of organs in the anemone body, if one thinks of each clustering of anemones as a single clonal individual. These elegant green pink-tipped Anthopleura elegantissima anemones grow on boulders on Pacific beaches or on rocks piled up to make breakwaters. Like the beadlets, each clone is incapable of tolerating non-self anemones within touching distance. The first result is a set of distinct border zones between clones, like the frontiers between warring states, traceable for yards across the boulders, what might be called the hate strips, separating one clone from another and each an inch or two wide. This social geography, a social distancing between genetically distinct anemones, has created what biologists have called a division of labour within each clone. At the outer edges, where there are no rivals, are a set of ordinary, quite small, free-edge anemones living an untroubled life. Along the borderlines with enemy clones are a set of little scout anemones. They are also relatively small and are often damaged when they enter the no-man's land between the lines and come too close to the other side, acting for their clone as sacrificial battle fodder. Sometimes, when badly wounded, a scout will make its way back into the body of the clone, away from the fighting, where it will recover. On occasions, a retreating scout is so badly wounded and infected by acroradial peels from the other side that its own relatives treat it as a foreigner and attack and kill it. Immediately behind the scouts, in the second, third, and sometimes fourth row, a tall, powerful, heavily armed warrior anemones, packed with toxic acroragi and capable of reaching out over the top of the scouts to do fearsome damage to the anemones of the far side. These warriors have been shown to have a memory of battles past. When confronted with enemy clones they have fought before, their defensive response is quicker and more immediately fierce than with newly met strangers. Intriguingly, the warriors seem almost never to propagate young anemones. That breeding function is reserved to other, lightly armed but big anemones called the reproductives that live in the centre of the clone, protected from any possible attack by the hedges of scouts and warriors that surround them. The clones, as David Eyre and Rick Grossberg have written, work as functionally integrated units. Attacks are coordinated, the scouts look to expand the territory, damaged warriors can be protected within the body of the clone, and chemical information about the state of play on the battlefront can be transferred by them to the reproductives. Experiments have shown that anemones can be trained up for different roles. Repeated exposure of ordinary free-edge anemones to the tentacles of other non-clone anemones results in them acquiring more and bigger acroragi. Warriors that moved back into the centre of the clone can grow bigger and become reproductives. Wounded scouts, withdrawn from the battlefront, can recover and provide a reserve from which future warriors or future reproductives could both be drawn. All these are evolved dimensions of the anemone self. Each polyp may be genetically identical to every other, but each cast within the clone is different in form. Different local conditions, life on the free outer edge where there are no enemies, the battlefront, the safe centre, summon different body forms from the same genetic source. Even here, in the very simplest of animals, the interplay of inheritance and environment defines the experience of life. It is difficult to remember that the animals behaving like this have nothing resembling a brain, nor any sense organs beyond an ability to detect the chemical difference between self and non-self. My brief trial in the tank with Redfoot and Bluefoot had been dramatic, but was not the natural reality as it evolved with these Americans. Unlike all battles between individual polyps from different clones, clone-to-clone battles typically continue for several days, repeatedly peaking during the flood tide, perhaps because that is when the sea brings in extra nutrients. Individual anemones bear their wounds like stars and continue fighting, even with the darts sticking out of them, and acroradial peels puckering their bodies. Only when a warrior crosses into enemy territory does it behave like those anemones caught in single combat, soon separating from the rocks and allowing the currents to waft it away, defeated. All this with no brain and no means of seeing or hearing. Even more extraordinarily, it now seems as if individual anemone polyps are able to make decisions which involve assessing the difference between themselves and a rival from another clone. Scientists at Plymouth University have staged meetings between beadlets of different sizes. Just as in red deer, when the weaker stag may decide to withdraw after a bout of roaring, after parallel walking, or only following a phase of violent antler wrestling, the smaller beadlet sometimes gave up and retreated after no fighting or when no damage had been done to it. The anemones were using logical decision rules similar to those observed in contests in animals that are often assumed to be more complex in their behaviour. Somehow, an anemone polyp can ask the strategic questions, is the other one stronger? Am I likely to lose? Will the cost of winning outweigh the benefit? Is discretion the better part of valour? Anemones, it seems, are logical polyps, capable of deference in front of the strong and assertion in front of the weak, and able in the light of those perceptions to conduct limited war. No one knows how, nor what kind of consciousness is alive in these animals. Perhaps anemones drive on to this far-reaching conclusion. There is no distinction between life and mind. Life is mind, and there is no boundary in the continuum of life at which you can draw a line to say, here is mind, and here is none. Life and mind is a single condition in which the living share. We are mind. We live in mind. To live is to be mind. Mind is the distinction between what lives and what doesn't. So that thought, that stream of consciousness that ebbs and flows in us, is the medium of being. Chapter 6. Heraclitus on the Shore. I have often thought of my father-in-law in this bay. John Raven died 10 years before I met Sarah, and so I never knew him, but I know, at least, he used to encourage her and her brothers and sisters to look for amethysts on the beach at Rua and Tassenach. He said you could find them here among the small grey pebbles eroded out of the margins of the volcanic dikes. I've often looked, but never found one. Perhaps they found them all. Nevertheless, John Raven remains here, partly at least because Sarah treasures the memory of going out to look for wild flowers with him when she was a girl. He was handsome, tall, increasingly thin, smoking his Benson and Hedges, crouched under an umbrella in the rain, the most careful of detectives, chatting, joking, looking down into the details of the world. An extraordinary man, a classical scholar with a mastery of the whole sweep of Greek philosophy, from Thales to the Hellenistic thinkers. A much-loved tutor at Cambridge, carefully setting out for the undergraduates the riches of his subject. A pacifist in the Second World War, who refused to countenance murder as a means to an end. A botanist of world standing, with a lovely, straightforward and systematic clarity of mind. Kind, funny and considerate to the young. An effortless and remorseless deflator of the pompous. A man, according to his dear friend Bobby Chapman, with a sepulchral laugh and a conspiratorial twinkle, who in the 1930s had a brief entrancement with Margot Fonteyn before she became the star of the dancing world. He was a watercolourist, a gardener, a fisherman, and a meticulous searcher after wild flowers here in Scotland and in the mountains of Greece and Crete, whose geography and ecology he knew as well as anyone on earth, and an adored father, often ill, who, even with all these gifts, was increasingly disabled by self-doubt and adrift toward self-destruction. The most lasting of his books, still available more than 60 years after it was first published, he wrote together with his fellow Cambridge classicist Geoffrey Kirk. The Pre-Socratic Philosophers addresses the thoughts of that group of Greek thinkers from the eastern Aegean and the settlements in Sicily and southern Italy, who, between about 600 BC and 400 BC, started to consider existence in new ways, beyond the traditional stories of gods and men. The relationship between sky and earth, Uranos and Gaia, no longer needed to be seen as a sexual drama played out in the clouds. At the dawn of metaphysical thinking, these first philosophers tried to articulate what being was, what the existence of things might be, what nature was. They were the first to ask the fundamental questions: what is the world? What is it made of? What are its principles? How can we know what it is? In the radically tidal world of the bay, I found myself reading over and over again what Kirk and Raven had written about Heraclitus, the strange, terse, misanthropic philosopher from the Aegean coast of Asia Minor, who lived in a state of constant strife with his neighbours in Ephesus, where he had been born around 540 BC, berating them for their idiocy, refusing to draw up a law code for a city that did not deserve one. The received idea of Heraclitus is simple. Panta rei, everything flows, all is flux. Nothing is fixed and nothing certain. Nothing can be known. There is no identity. Tides run through everything, and there is no still stand. We are afloat in a liquid world. Both Plato and Aristotle thought this ridiculous. How could anyone say, Plato asked, that there is no solidity in anything? The word Plato used meant health or soundness. But that everything is liquid like a leaky pot, or people afflicted with catarrh, dribbling and trickling all day long? It is the kind of remark I imagine John Raven might have made, but the revelatory treatment of Heraclitus in The Pre-Socratic Philosophers looks beyond that exaggerated and rubbed-down cliché and starts to reveal Heraclitus even in his cryptic, fragmentary obscurity, sometimes no more communicative than a crab, as a thinker who questions the world in a way that now seems extraordinarily modern. All the pre-Socratics had been interested in change and in the way change governs what we experience every day. The question was not whether change was part of the world, but how identity and meaning persisted despite it. What is the structure underlying change? Is the crab the same crab as it goes through its metamorphoses? To what extent, as I read Kirk and Raven here now, both of them long dead, do they remain present? Heraclitus asked his neighbours to look beyond the everyday. It was no good thinking that the world consisted of details. There is something that unites everything, which he called the logos, the principle of order and knowledge. That measure is present in all change. It is the hidden stability that runs behind and through change. The governing principle of the Logos is that opposites unite. The path up and down is one and the same. Fish can live only in the sea, but salt water is poisonous to men. Exhaustion makes rest good, and only hunger makes a full stomach pleasant. None of these things would have the meaning they do without their opposites. So that when Heraclitus says that opposites are the same, he does not mean identical, but that they are deeply linked. Opposites are two parts of one substance that undergoes change according to the measure of the Logos. The tide is a model of existence. High tide and low tide are not separate things. It is the same sea that ebbs and floods, so that high tide is inconceivable without low tide. This embracing of a systematic understanding, whose wholeness relies on its union of opposites, became, for Heraclitus, the source of wisdom and goodness. Man's life is indissociably bound up with his whole surroundings. Wisdom consists in understanding the Logos, the common element of arrangement in things, embodying the measure which ensures that change does not produce disconnected, chaotic plurality. And what of the most Heraclitean statement of all? You cannot step into the same river twice, since the river is so changeable that each time you dip a foot in, it is a different river. On those grounds, as Cratylus, one of Heraclitus's followers, said to Plato, you could not step into the same river even once, because the changes in a river are so constant that at the very moment you step into it, it has become a different river. It turns out, as I now learn from my father-in-law and his ancient colleague, that Heraclitus never said such a thing. It is Plato's crude and ridiculing version of what Heraclitus had actually said, which is both subtler and more obvious. Upon those that step into the same rivers, different and different waters flow. He was only saying what he had said before. The river remains the same, but its waters are always different. The form does not change, but its substance is never still. The unity of the river depends on the regularity of its flux. It is a river because it changes. If it did not change, it would be a lake. The opposites are one, and a single river can exist only as a thing of many waters. The same is true of my tidal rock pools. They are what they are only because at each high tide they cease to be what they were at low tide. Their changingness is their identity. No one in Ephesus could understand that the world was like this, not full of atomized and individualized facts and appearances, but all in common, all part of one structure. Heraclitus felt he had access to a unique understanding that the world was a system, of which individual nodes, fixed points, and things could mean nothing beyond the web of which they were part. Everything consists only in its relationships to everything else. He sounds at times indistinguishable from a modern systems theorist such as Gregory Bateson or the Californian physicist Fridtjof Capra, who understood the physical world as a dynamic web of interrelated events. In a living system, Capra wrote, the components change continually. There is a ceaseless flux of matter through a living organism. Each cell continually synthesizes and dissolves structures and eliminates waste products. Tissues and organs replace themselves. Matter continuously flows through an organism, but its form remains stable. In this Heraclitean view, nothing in existence is fundamental. Only in connection does meaning occur, and the observer is necessarily part of that web. The Heraclitean world is not static or closed, but dynamic and open. Everything within this frame of order floods through everything, not like a leaking pot or a man with a streaming cold, but like an organism metamorphosing from crab to egg, to zoea, to megalops, to crab to egg again, or a rock pool flicking from a weed and crab-rich state to a weedless and winkle-rich state, and back again. There is no question of equilibrium or stasis here, or even solidity, but an understanding of existence. In the words of Norbert Wiener, the MIT mathematician who invented cybernetics in the 1950s, as a set of whirlpools in a river of ever-flowing water, not stuff that abides, but patterns that perpetuate themselves. Life is a disequilibrium, whose only stability is in its passages through time. Life, from that point of view, is the continual embodiment of the system's pattern of organization. Just as a waveform remains stable, but the water through which it travels, and of which it is made, is never and can never be the same. There is no sense of calm in Heraclitus. His picture is of a world in tension with itself, full of structures that are taut with an internal and hidden antagonism, as if in that tension lay the verve and energy of life itself. All things happen by strife and necessity, one fragment says. The world is not unlike the rock pool, full of claim and concealment, attack and evasion. Nature likes to hide, another says cryptically. What is true is not necessarily apparent. You may perceive a state of balance and calm, but it is held like that between forces that are secretly straining against each other. They do not understand, Heraclitus began another famous and difficult fragment, again disparaging his neighbours and referring to something that might be life or existence. How, being at variance, it agrees with itself. There is a back-stretched connection, as in the bow and the lyre. The bodies of the bow and lyre pull against their constraining strings, and in that tension combine to create a coherent whole. The essence of life consists of opposite forces in tension. These strange and powerful statements, so nearly lost, this one preserved by the church father Hippolytus in the 3rd century AD, seem to address the nature of this shore, of life on it, its governing structures and habits, what it is. The apparent stability and reality and existence of life is only part of the grand process of things on the cosmic battlefield. All things must eventually change, while, for the time being, some things are evidently real and even good, held in reality by the tensions that frame them. The world order, for which the Greek word is cosmos, always was and is and shall be an everlasting fire, kindling in measures and going out in measures. That cosmic fire is the everlasting burning of existence, the medium of change through which all things continuously pass, and which, at its heart, has no peace. In one of Heraclitus's most concentrated formulations, this one preserved by Origen, the great Alexandrian theologian, he says simply, "Strife is justice." If there were no strife, as Kirk and Raven commented, the victor in every contest of extremes would establish a permanent domination, and the world as such would be destroyed. If the body of the bow or lyre wins the struggle and the strings break, there can be no bow or lyre. Their strife is wholeness. The idea that competition creates order is implicit in Darwinian theory. Even at home in Kent, as Darwin described in the 1860 edition of On the Origin of Species, the removal of one species at the top of a food web can disrupt all the layers of predator and prey beneath it. Each trophic level, the Greek word means simply nutritional, defining organisms by what they consume, is dependent on strife between the levels above it. I have reason to believe that humble bees are indispensable to the fertilization of the heart's ease, Viola tricolor, for other bees do not visit this flower. From experiments which I have lately tried, I have found that the visits of bees are necessary for the fertilization of some kinds of clover, but humble bees alone visit the red clover, Trifolium praetensi, as other bees cannot reach the nectar. Hence, I have very little doubt that if the whole genus of humblebees became extinct, or very rare in England, the heartsease and red clover would become very rare, or wholly disappear. The number of humblebees in any district depends in a great degree on the number of field mice, which destroy their combs and nests, and Mr. H. Newman, who has long attended to the habits of humblebees, believes that more than two-thirds of them are thus destroyed all over England. Now, the number of mice is largely dependent, as everyone knows, on the number of cats, and Mr. Newman says, "Near villages and small towns I have found the nests of humblebees more numerous than elsewhere, which I attribute to the number of cats that destroy the mice." More cats meant fewer mice meant more bees. More bees meant more pollinators for heartsease and red clover, more of their seeds fertilised, and so more plants. Cats made flowers. Remove the cats and the flowers would go. In that way, competition creates order, or in Heraclitus's terms, justice. That dynamic picture, not of static niches but of competitive and tensed relationships between multiple predators and a mutually exploitative but non-destructive symbiosis of bees and flowers, is essentially Heraclitian, but did not take centre stage in biology until the 1960s. For most of the 20th century, the patterns and structure of the living world were thought of in terms of energy flows, controlled by the quantity and quality of natural resources. The governing fact was assumed to be that there could never be more consumers than the supplies on which they lived. In 1960, three pioneer ecologists at the University of Michigan, called Nelson Hairston, Frederick Smith, and Lawrence Slobodkin, published a four-page paper asking a different question. Why is the world green? Answer, because the world's herbivores, which would otherwise proliferate to the point where they ate every green thing, are controlled from above by their predators and parasites. That is why there is always far more green food for them than they consume. Only when the predators are gone does the herbivore population balloon and the green world disappear. The opposite destinies of those alternating trophic levels mirror those in Darwin's garden. Cats meant clover, and no cats meant no clover. The Michigan insight was to globalise that understanding. If predators thrived, herbivores suffered, and the vegetation grew. Resources did not dictate the pattern of life. Competition did. Tigers made forests. Drawing on these insights, a big-boned 6-foot-6-inch New Englander called Robert Treat Paine III became the modern giant of intertidal studies. He came from a long patrician line of Boston Brahmins, descendant of the great English revolutionary Tom Paine and of one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence. More important than all that was an early and deep engagement with the aristocracy of evolutionary biology. At Harvard, mentored by the great historian of biological sciences, Ernst Mayr, a PhD student at Michigan under Frederick E. Smith, one of the authors of the Green World Hypothesis, and a postdoc at the equally distinguished Scripps Institution on the Pacific Coast in San Diego. It was on the edge of the wharf there in 1961, when he was in his late 20s, that Paine had an idea derived from the Green World Hypothesis, for an experimental test. Beneath him, at the dock, he watched the huge carnivorous purple sea star, Pisaster acrasius, fat-limbed and extraordinarily strong, eating a big Californian mussel, Mytilus californianus. The following year, he took a post on the zoology faculty at the University of Washington in Seattle, where he remained until 1998. The riches of the northeastern Pacific shoreline were in touching distance, 4 hours' drive from the campus, and the bays and islands of that spectacular fog and rain-soaked coast became his laboratory. First on the mainland, and then on Tatoosh Island off Cape Flattery, no power or running water, Paine established his University of the Rocks. Arrival at Tatoosh involved either trusting to the professor's boat skills in a zodiac on a thrashing shore, or being hoisted off the deck of a bucking Coast Guard boat in a wooden box dangling 100 feet in the air, then swinging in the wind onto a platform on top of the island. No one who spent any time there with what one of his students called this canopy of a man could ever forget it. From his boyhood, Payne had been in love with high-latitude rocky shores, and for almost 4 decades he and his train of devoted followers worked there on the complex invertebrate communities of the intertidal, slowly establishing a school of biologists who talked and thought less about niches than the dynamics of systems, the complex wiring of species interactions, and the all-importance of the small manipulative experiment. Their repeated task was to see what happened when changes were made to 1 or 2 details of the plants or animals of the intertidal. The experiments may have looked small and parochial, but their findings revolutionised the science of natural systems in every habitat on Earth. All his life, Payne's mantra remained the same: an ultimate understanding of the underlying causal processes can only be arrived at by study of local situations. Reality may be tidal, it is also full of local variation. He always assumed that everyone and everything, as a group of his most distinguished followers wrote when he died in 2016, would be a delicate tangle of interactions and effects. From June 1963 until November the following year, Payne made his first world-changing experiment. He analysed the food web of a stretch of shoreline on the Washington coast, about 25 feet long and 6 feet high. His diagram of the web, thick with zoological Latin, revealed a complex community. At the bottom, the large fleshy seaweeds were eaten by sea urchins, limpets, winkles, and the strange flat rock-clinging creatures called chitons. The hard, crust-forming coralline algae were also eaten by chitons and sea anemones. Those algae-eating creatures were themselves preyed on by whelks, starfish and sea stars of different kinds. At the top of the system, sea anemones and the soft-bodied sea squirts, as well as the mat-forming bryozoans and the tiny tube-forming worms and sponges, plus the barnacles, goose barnacles and blue mussels, were preyed on by dog whelks, sea snails of various sorts, and the sea slugs called nudibranchs. Vast quantities of many of them and of the big Californian mussel, Mytilus californianus, that Payne had watched in San Diego, were consumed by the huge sea star, the carnivorous purple Pisaster or Crasius, which was effortlessly removing 20 to 60 barnacles at one time. As Payne described, that big mussel, when in action, also had its own brute-force competitive capacities. Small barnacles are smothered. Larger species, such as the barnacle Semibalanus cariosus, are overgrown and then abraded to death. The goose-necked barnacle Polycipes is gradually crushed, and so on. It was a ferocious and layered world, full of strife. The experiment asked a simple question: what would happen to this multi-level community if the dominant Pisaster was removed? From his chosen patch, he prized off all the Pisasters with a crowbar and hurled them as far as he could into the sea. If, in the course of the year, they reappeared, he wrenched them off again and threw them back out. A control area next to his plot was allowed to pursue its natural course of events. Throughout the year, he watched the changes. First, once the sea stars had gone, the barnacles floated in from the sea and established themselves on the rocks. By the following summer, the barnacles were being crowded out by rapidly growing Californian mussels, and at least to begin with, by the big goose barnacles. Even they were then squeezed out by the grinding dominance of the mussels. The seaweeds were disappearing because the mussels were taking up all the space. The chitons and the bigger limpets had also left, as they had nowhere to go and nothing to eat. Sponges and nudibranchs had gone, along with most of the sea anemones. The bryozoans, the little tube-forming worms and the encrusting coralline seaweeds, were all on their way out, driven away by the tyrannical monoculture of mussels that were no longer under pressure from Pisaster. The community had collapsed. Previously, there had been 15 different species on this patch of shore. Now there were 8. Removing Pisaster had crashed the diversity of species. In the absence of predation, the mussel had won. The experiment had shown that predation did not, as had generally been assumed, diminish life, but opened the opportunities for a variety of life to flourish, something which in the green world hypothesis had been merely a suggestion, had been shown by Payne to be fact. When Robert MacArthur, the great early ecologist and professor at Princeton, read Payne's 1966 paper announcing these findings, he wrote him a letter. This changes everything. Removal of predators leads to local extinctions. Where predators capable of preventing monopolies are missing, the system becomes less diverse. If justice, or order, in the Heraclitean sense, is the balanced coexistence of multiple forms of life, with different demands and different ways of being, Payne had shown that kind of order to be dependent on a condition of mutual strife in which no one power source could dominate all others. In a ripple of papers emerging over the following years from Tatoosh, he gave the name of keystone species to a top predator in such a system. Remove it, and the arch beneath would collapse. The collapse itself often took the form of a rippling sequence of changes that ran down and through the food web, a form of interaction Payne labelled the trophic cascade. Scientists began to find trophic cascades and their knock-on effects wherever they looked, many created by the impact of human beings on the natural world. Rivers, reefs, lakes, tundras, jungles, mountains and savannas all demonstrated the reality of the idea, to the extent that by 2011 a leading group of earth and life specialists could announce in Science the trophic downgrading of planet Earth. The deep damage done by people to community organizing predators, they wrote, was implicated in the planet's 6th mass extinction, which is characterized by the loss of larger-bodied animals in general and of apex consumers in particular. That loss is arguably humankind's most pervasive influence on the natural world. The disastrous cascade in Yellowstone, by which the killing of wolves had allowed elk to boom and graze out all the trees, became globally famous, but no instance of the catastrophe is more striking than the one developed over several decades by James Estes, Robert Anthony, and others in the North Pacific. In 1974, Estes and John Palmisano had already discovered in the Aleutian Islands that where sea otters survived, the beds of kelp around the islands and all their associated organisms, including rock greenlings, seals and even bald eagles, were in rude health. Where the otters had been destroyed by fur hunters, there was no kelp, no rock greenling, no seals and no bald eagles. The link in the cascade was the sea urchin. Sea otters preyed on them and kept their numbers down. When the otters were killed, the urchins boomed. Urchins eat kelp, and they graze the kelp forest down to nothing. The fish had nowhere to hide, the seals and eagles had no fish to eat, and the system collapsed to a derelict, weedless world of urchins and mussels. It was later found that killer whales were preying on those otters that remained, and that bald eagles, with no fish or otter pups to hunt, turned to rock ptarmigan and various gulls for prey. These bird dinners were nutritionally better than the fish on which they had been relying, and the bald eagles did better than before. It may be that the killer whales had turned to preying on the otters, because their traditional prey of the calves of larger whales had been reduced or removed by human whaling. If so, the result is a cascade that runs from 1. An increase in human pressure, 2. A crash of the larger whales, 3. A knock-on effect in the killer whales, 4. A decrease in sea otters, 5. an increase in urchins. 6, a decrease in kelp. 7, a knock-on effect decreasing the rock greenlings. And 8, another in changing the predatory targets of the eagles with a subsidiary cascade. 9, on seabirds whose numbers were reduced, and so 10, released predatory pressure on sand eels and other small prey fish, allowing 11, mackerel to boom, which then also 12, became the prey of bald eagles whose population thrived. The science has developed subtleties since the pioneering days. It is clear now that bottom-up processes, above all the supply of nutrients or side-in effects, the battering of storms and the vagaries of weather, the particularities of particular places, will also have their effect. An organism, it has been shown, can act as a keystone some of the time, but not at others. A cascade can occur through non-lethal effects, as when winkles leave a pool whose water is tainted with the smell of crab. These dynamic structures themselves shift. In a complex web with multiple pathways, the cascading wave of damage can be dissipated and buffered as it ripples through the system, so that in some cases the shock of removing a top predator can be accommodated within the system without deep change. Nevertheless, these discoveries have transformed the way we must understand the world. Truly, to see a shoreline now is to recognise that its strife is its order, that a balanced community is dependent on power centres in tension, the frame pulling against the strings of Heraclitus's bow or lyre, and that the injustice and diminution of a dominant monoculture represents the absence of strife. It is a paradigm of nature opposite to the idea that living things hang happily and stably together in a set of mutually accommodated niches. It substitutes tension for stillness, flux for calm. Heraclitus is now the spirit that presides over life between the tides. It is a mind-changing recognition. Even sailing out one evening in the bay, I am more than ever aware of the mobility of things. The ebb tide is setting to the east, squeezing around the castle headland on which the lighthouse has been built, and slipping downstream of it in volutes of sea that turn in and in. The wind is following the tide, channeled by the hills around the sound, so that whatever its origins, it too drives eastwards towards Lismore and the glens in Appin. The dinghy kicks and lurches in the chop, its bow taken one way and then the other, until the wind gathers and the canvas tightens and the sheet hardens in my hand. This now feels like a model of the stable disequilibrium at the heart of things, and of Heraclitus's and Bob Payne's understanding of them. Nothing is stable, and yet everything coheres. Nothing is fixed. The sail itself, the sheet running from it to my right hand, the rudder and its tiller in the other, my own body and its balancing weight on the gunwale, constantly moving in and out of the boat at each change in the wind, a knock from the sea. If any one of those forces were allowed to slip or dominate, the wholeness, what Heraclitus calls justice or the indicated way, would fall off into incoherence. I am the governor for a moment, holding in tension the competing pressures. The coexistence of many species, Bob Payne wrote, is characteristic of ecologically uncertain relationships. Diversity is unpredictability, non-singularity is life. That may be obvious, plurality flowers in the absence of the monomaniac, but Payne's great discovery was the same as Heraclitus's. Creative acts of uncertainty are dependent on an overarching control in the logos. An overall authority, which in human terms might be called the rule of law, is the only thing that can allow diversity to flower. That is the picture in this boat. If I let go of the tiller, allow the sheet to run out in my hand, or do not balance on the gunwale the forces of wind and tide, one or other of them will take control, and, overpowered or underpowered, the boat will either capsize or come to a stop. It would suffer what biologists call a regime shift and move to a state, either upside down or motionless, where its organisation and structure had gone. The New Yorker writer, Elizabeth Colbert, has reported what a climatologist told her about the state of the world's atmosphere. It was, he said, like a small boat. You can tip and then you'll just go back. You can tip it and just go back. And then you tip it and you go to the other stable state, which is upside down. Dinghy, climate or the biosphere, the Heraclitean logic applies. It is late summer. The flag irises are heavy with bulbous seed heads. No birdsong now. Marsh orchids are flowering in the long grass in front of the house. Young buzzards are learning the wind by the cliff edge, flicked up and flustered when a gust ambushes them, only slowly inching back into steady air. There have been days of rain and the blackberries are juicy but almost tasteless with the wet. In the pool at Ruhr and Tassenach, where both beadlet and snake-locks anemones are now proliferating, 50 of each of them, I am wondering if anything I have done on this shoreline has brought about any changes to its life. When a black, green and yellow dragonfly comes beside me, almost to the water surface, and bending its long tail down towards the pool, deposits its eggs there. Careful and hesitant, like a man placing a piece on a chessboard in a move of which he is not quite sure. It is a golden-ringed dragonfly, which would not have done that if the pool had not been there. Then, I wonder, would a dragonfly lay its eggs in a saltwater pool? Was that an indication that the salinity was down? Perhaps the quantities of rain and the low levels of penetration by the neap tides had diluted the saltiness of the water to the point where it was as much a land pool as a sea pool. The next day, a cloud of tiny fish were in there, two spotted gobies, each with a black patch on their tail, perhaps to mimic an eye, and bright iridescent blue spots on the sides. These gobies are among the fish whose males defend the eggs after they have been laid, fanning and cooling them in the nest, but which are also the regular practitioners of what is called filial cannibalism. If they are hungry, or the price of defending the eggs against other males is too high, the father eats them and hopes for a more productive outcome next time. No such scenes here. These gobies were all hanging in the pool in mid-water, all at different angles and occupying all levels, but now and then coming to the surface for a fly, rising and sinking away again with real speed, the quickness of that up-and-grab necessary to avoid the bird predators. It was never an entirely clean hit, but a kind of double-take, a nibble and then a nibble, a splash and then a flash of the body away. I sat for an age watching the rings of the rising fish coming up like raindrops from below. The third day, I arrived at the pool to find all the rocks around it covered in gull droppings. The big platform in the southeast corner, the boulders on the north shore, the three or four promontory rocks Tom and I had manoeuvred into the edges of the pool, on the southern cliff and by the shallows on the western side, all were painted with the white liquid splashes of gull droppings, looking like the aftermath of a party no one had bothered to clear up. The gobies were gone. There was a half-eaten corpse of one on the floor of the pool, a quarter of an inch long, its little spine poking through the white of its flesh, the skull and tail eaten, and the glitter of its scales crumpled and broken. The gobies had been caught in here. With relatively little weed in the pool, there had been nowhere for them to hide. The flock of common gulls which hangs around the bay had sat like judges above the water and picked them off. Even here, I realised, I had changed the ecology. On a coast with no pools, there would have been nowhere for the gobies to have been caught by the withdrawal of the water. They could have swept in and out with the tide. I had created a gull restaurant and played my part in the smallest of local trophic cascades. Man makes a pool, accidentally traps gobies, provides food for gulls, and the gulls leave leftovers for crabs and other largely molluscan detritivores. A mammal, fish, bird, crustacean, invertebrate combination of cascade and knock-on effect from which all benefited in our different ways, all except the fish. With complete inevitability, the pool had become yet another theatre in which Heraclitean strife and justice held sway.